13. Aunt Hester. I did not accompany Poirot to Kingfisher's View, and so did not witness firsthand any of the events that I am about to describe. I feel exactly as I did, however, because Poirot brought the scene to life for me later in vivid detail, and I hope that my account captures everything with the same vitality here. The first thing my friend noticed about Hester and Percy Semley's house was that it was superior to Little Key in every possible respect. It was more attractive from the outside, had more impressive gardens, and was positioned in a more secluded part of the Kingfisher Hill estate. It had a better sense of balance and proportion inside. Poirot could not help noting also that there was no point of perilous altitude in the entrance hall of Kingfisher's View from which a person might be pushed to his death. As Poirot arrived with Percy Semley, an English setter bounded forward to greet them. The dog was white, with orange ears and a smattering of orange freckles, although that is probably not strictly how one should describe them, and he made several attempts to bite Poirot's gloved hand in a genial sort of way. It was not an attack, more a case of him wanting to have a friendly chew on this exciting new visitor. A second dog lolloped forward as Percy Semley was trying to persuade the more energetic one to leave Poirot in peace. This dog was taller and heavier than the bouncier one, and also an English setter. White, with dark grey patches that, according to Poirot, made him look like a Dalmatian designed by someone with no sense of discipline. Hester Semley, who appeared next, was a small, bony, bespectacled woman, with thick, coiled springs of white hair all over her head. Poirot estimated her age at around 60. She spoke and moved very quickly. Once introductions had been made, she held forth at length. "I'm delighted to meet you, Monsieur Poirot. I'm aware of your work, of course. What brings you to Kingfisher Hill? Oh, well, no doubt you will tell me all about it in a moment. Percy, take his coat, take his hat. Sterling, do be patient. I see you've met the boys, Monsieur Poirot. Sterling is the one pestering you. Don't worry, he won't hurt you. I don't think he likes the taste of your glove. They're leather, are they not? Sterling doesn't like the smell of leather. Never mind, you weren't to know. Just wait, Sterling. Percy, take his gloves. Put them in the pocket of his coat. Sterling only wants to nibble on your hand a little, Monsieur Poirot. It's his way of saying hello and showing you that he wants to be your friend. As soon as you sit down, he'll forget about your hands and give your face a good lick instead. He's not shy like his older brother. Pound! Pound, come here and say hello to our guest. He's a most eminent detective and solver of many murders. Isn't that right, Monsieur Poirot? Who knows when someone so distinguished will next visit us? If I were you, Pound, I would follow your little brother's example and make the most of this opportunity. Pound, the setter, did not think an illustrious guest was anything to get excited about. He settled down on the floor and started to lick his front paw. "You have named your dogs Pound and Sterling," said Poirot, "after your great British currency?" "I have," said Hester Semley, ferociously, as if she were not merely answering a question, but also renewing a commitment. "Those fools in charge of us will see us taken out of the gold standard if someone doesn't stop them. It's a terrible thing. They say the pound cannot retain its value. No doubt it will not, thanks to their idiocy. But the way I see it is perfectly simple, Monsieur Poirot. If you have no ability when it comes to fiscal matters, then do not involve yourself in fiscal matters. But I'm sure you have not come here to be told how I would organise the affairs of this great country if I were the government." "I am sure you would do an excellent job," Poirot told her. "Oh, I would," she agreed, as she ushered him into her drawing-room. "I most certainly would. If I undertake to do any job, I make sure I do it well, which is why I shall endeavour to answer your questions to the best of my ability. No doubt you wish to ask me all about the murder of the young woman at Little Key?" The dogs had followed them into the drawing-room. Sterling sat panting enthusiastically beside Poirot's chair, but mercifully did not try to lick his face. "Monsieur Poirot wishes to know my whereabouts when the crime was committed, Arnhead," said Percy. "I told him I was with you." "He was with me, Monsieur Poirot. And you might think I would say that, even if it were untrue, but I would not. People need to face the consequences of their actions, whether one is related to them by blood or not. Percy Semley, if you ever break the law, I shall report you straight to the police, nephew or no nephew." "I know, Aunt Head." It sounded to Poirot as if Percy had responded to this assertion in these precise terms many times before. "So, is that all you wish to know?" Hester Semley asked. "Surely not, since this young woman was killed at Little Key and is hardly the first to suffer that fate in that house. Percy, go and make tea or coffee. Which would you prefer, Monsieur Poirot?" "I will take coffee, thank you." You are right. I would also like to ask you about the murder of Frank Devonport. He had been about to say more, but Hester Semele had already begun to answer, and continued to answer for some time thereafter. I know nothing about the murder of Frank Devonport, apart from what everybody knows, that his fiancée, Helen Acton, confessed and is to be hanged, and that she told the police that the reason she did it was because she had fallen in love with Richard Devonport. Balderdash. Now, if a woman engaged to Richard claimed to have fallen for Frank, that I would have no trouble believing. But it simply would not happen in reverse. So, what was Helen Acton's true motive? That is what you must find out, Monsieur Poirot. Mustn't he, Sterling? That's right. Oh, are you one of those people who doesn't like to be licked? He will only do it for a few moments. It's easier if you don't make a fuss. Now, what you might not know is that on the day that Frank was killed, there was something of an exodus early in the morning from Little Quay to here. Richard, Daisy, Godfrey and Werner all came here at about 9:30 in the morning. Sidney and Lillian insisted on having the house to themselves for Frank's grand welcome ceremony. Well, they could have saved themselves the bother if they'd simply not expelled him from the family in the first place. Some people are nothing but fools. Your son steals from you, and you fail to report him to the police. You protect him from the law, at the same time as disowning him. I ask you, what sense does that make? No sense. I would have done the precise opposite. She paused for breath, and Poirot took his chance. Please tell me everything that happened that day. You say that Richard and Daisy Devonport and the Laviolettes arrived 9:30 after nine. Monsieur Oliver Proud was not with them? No, he was in London. He arrived shortly before 2 o'clock and expressed a certain dissatisfaction with the situation. Mildly, mind you. He wasn't threatening a revolution or anything like that. He wouldn't dare. Daisy has him wrapped around her little finger. It was only that he did not see why they should all have to wait here until invited back to Little Quay by Sidney or Lillian. He was tactful about it, but it was clear that he found the whole production to be overly dramatic and irrational, and when he said so, Daisy went wild and started to scream at him that he had no right to criticise her family, of which he was not yet a member, even by marriage, and would never become one if he continued to say such things. Her tirade was vicious and relentless. You were most upset by it, weren't you, Pound? Of course, it makes perfect sense when you think about it. What? Daisy and Oliver had both missed Frank dreadfully. The torment of knowing that he was back at Little Quay, and yet still they were not permitted to see him. Not that anyone had ever told Oliver that he couldn't see Frank, but their friendship had ended, that's for sure. She broke off. I've forgotten what I was talking about. Oh, yes. I was saying that Daisy and Oliver can hardly be blamed for venting their ill temper on one another. They must both have been in a state of nervous agitation at the imminent prospect of seeing Frank again, and yet also being made to wait by that bully, Sidney Devonport. Dreadful man. Daisy takes after him. She can be rather dreadful herself. She likes to be in charge of everything and is afraid of almost nothing, but she is afraid of Sidney. You should have heard her earlier, Aunt Het, Percy cut in. She told Sidney exactly what she thinks of him. She really seemed to want to crush him. Do not speak while I am speaking, Percy. But you're always speaking, Aunt Het. Perhaps Daisy has finally conquered her fear of her father, continued Hester. It will be good for her if she has. Certainly on the day of Frank's murder, she was still scared of him. That is why she set about poor Oliver with such savagery. She knew he was quite right to find the situation ridiculous, all of them waiting here like fools for no good reason, and her pride couldn't bear it. She's far too proud and vain to say, I know father's demands are objectionable, but I'm afraid to stand up to him. So instead, she took it out on Oliver, who had inadvertently drawn her attention to her own weakness and subservience. Many people are not at all ashamed of their own fears, Monsieur Poirot, but Daisy is. Her subjugation to Sidney ate away at her. I could see it. Poirot opened his mouth, which Hester Semele took as an opportunity to accelerate her own disquisition. Most people are endlessly willing to be frightened of one thing or another. Oh, that's not how they would see it. They would say they were respectful of social conventions or concerned with sparing the feelings of others. Balderdash! They are cowards who know nothing of freedom. Still, I don't know why we're talking about those people, because we're supposed to be talking about Daisy, who is the opposite. She wishes, and she always wished, to live free and unafraid. Yet, in a cruel irony, she is the daughter of Sidney Devonport. Percy, you should have been a Devonport child. You would have made a good one. Why aren't you fetching the coffee? Oh, I forgot about that, said Percy. He hurried away to do her bidding, closing the door behind him. He's not very bright, Hester told Poirot. What was I? Oh, yes, you wanted to know what happened on the day that Frank was killed. I can only tell you what happened here. Daisy was still berating Oliver when Winnie arrived. Winnie is the Devonport servant. Remind me to tell you something important about her. Sydney had sent her over here to tell everybody that at last they could return to Little Key, which is what most of them did, but not Oliver. Daisy was so angry with him that she told him he was not welcome to accompany her. Poor chap. I don't think I was the only one who felt sorry for him. Godfrey Le Violette immediately suggested a round of golf to cheer Oliver up, and the three of them went off to play. Godfrey, Oliver and Percy. Pound Sterling and I stayed here, didn't we, boys? We had a little nap. Then the golf was returned after about an hour and a half. Percy took the boys out for a run in the woods. Seeing the question forming on Poirot's face, Hester said, Not Godfrey and Oliver. I should hardly describe Godfrey Le Violette as a boy, even if he does have that strange, smooth skin that seems never to wrinkle. I meant the dogs. My boys. She reached over and stroked Pound, who rolled onto his back and stuck his legs in the air. Sterling, as if noticing the unequal distribution of attention, sat up and prodded Poirot with his front paw. Poirot calculated that he could not risk stroking him unless he wished to be licked again, which he decidedly did not. Now, something you will certainly want to know about if you're interested in the Devonport family is the conversation that took place between Godfrey and Oliver that afternoon while Percy was out and after they had all played golf. You must remind me to tell you all about that, as well as Winnie Lord. And after that, well, I'm not sure I'm able to offer any further assistance. You evidently don't believe that Frank was murdered by his fiancée, Helen Acton. No, you don't, or else you would not have asked about everybody's movements on that day. But if you're thinking that someone else killed Frank, I can only say that I'm sure you're right, and it could have been anyone, anyone at all. I mean, obviously it was neither of the Le Violettes, but... Why is this obvious? Poirot asked. Please, I'm speaking. Hester Semele sighed. Now I must interrupt the flow of my thoughts in order to answer you. It is obvious because Godfrey and Werner are decent, kind-hearted people. I'm very fond of them both. They would never kill anybody. Whereas any of the Devonports might, because they are either a tyrant, in the case of Sydney, or else they have had their personalities so disfigured by living with a tyrant that all kinds of destructive seeds have very likely been sown. I see that you have another question for me. You may ask it. Poirot was reluctant to fill the blissful and unexpected silence with words. He said, My friend, Inspector Catchpool, he was surprised when Helen Acton described Werner La Violette to us as kind. I will admit I, too, was a little surprised. Then you're both fools, said Hester. Werner is one of my favourite people. You could not hope to meet a kinder, more thoughtful woman. Do you know how we met? No, how could you? I'll tell you. Godfrey and Werner used to own Little Key, though it was called Kingfisher's Rest in those days, a much more suitable name, and the estate committee really should have forbidden Sydney to change it. I don't give a fig about it coming from the pen of Charles Dickens. So does Uncle Pumblechook. How would you feel if one of your neighbours named his house Uncle Pumblechook? She seemed to be waiting for an answer. As solemnly as he could, Poirot said, I understand that the Devonport's original plan was to buy this house. It was. Everything had been agreed. Then they discovered that the Le Violettes wished to sell Kingfisher's Rest, and Godfrey offered them a very good price. I can't help thinking he must have been desperate for money, in fact, because really, why else would he have sold the house for so much less than it was worth? It was a deal that only a fool would refuse, even if this house is a great deal more aesthetically pleasing than Uncle Pumblechook, which is what I shall call the Devonport's house from now on. In any case, that is how Werner and I became friends. We had been neighbours in the estate for some time, but I didn't know her well. After Sydney decided to buy her house instead of mine, she came to see me, to apologise and to make sure I was going to be all right. She was incredibly charming and gracious about the whole affair and offered to help me find a new buyer for this house. I told her, no, thank you. You see, Monsieur Poirot, something strange had happened. As soon as Sydney Devonport told me that he no longer wished to buy my house, the very second the words left that unsightly gargoyle mouth of his, I knew that I did not want to sell my house, not to him and not to anybody. Hearing him say so casually that he didn't want to live here, made me realise that, in fact, I did. There then followed several more minutes, during which Hester Semele explained why Kingfisher's view was more advantageous than any other house she had ever encountered. Poirot spared me those particular details. As soon as he was able to make himself heard, Poirot said, Could there have been another reason for the La Violettes wanting to sell their house? One that had nothing to do with money? I suppose so, though I cannot think what it might have been. Immediately before they decided to sell, had anything changed on the estate? Nothing at all. Things rarely change here at Kingfisher Hill, and thank goodness for that. What about Monsieur Alfred Bixby and the Kingfisher Coach Company? Asked Poirot. What about them? Do not some residents disapprove of Monsieur Bixby and his business? The vulgarity of the blue and orange charabanc and his use of the name Kingfisher? Oh, yes, but that was long before Godfrey and Verner bought a house here. The tawdriness of Mr. Bixby predates us all. Wait. Hester Semley sat up straight and pushed her spectacles higher up her nose. Something had changed at Kingfisher Hill, and just before Godfrey and Verner decided to sell their house, too. The gate porter had changed. I objected most strongly, but I was alone in my objection, and eventually I had to concede defeat. No one was on my side, apart from Lavinia Stent, and she is worse than useless. Even Percy thought I was being unreasonable. The gate porter, said Poirot. Yes, at the entrance to the estate. The old one retired, and a new one was put in his place. A man of distinctly unsuitable appearance. Did you not notice him as you arrived? Covered in hair. Almost no forehead to speak of. His hairline starts no more than an inch above his eyebrows. As it happens, his predecessor, the old gate porter, was at the opposite end of the scale. He was as bald as a golf ball and had no eyebrows to speak of. But he always looked smart, unlike this new fellow. And who could object to a golf ball? It's not this new chap's fault, I can see that, and I'm not opposed to hairiness in and of itself, and I'm sure the new porter is a reliable and polite employee. In fact, I know he is. But was there any need to position him at the entrance gates so that everybody sees him the moment they arrive? Could he not have been put somewhere less public, less visible? What are you grinning about, Monsieur Poirot? Are you thinking that I am a ridiculous old woman to care about such things? I am thinking, said Poirot, that thanks to you, the pieces of a small puzzle begin to fall into place. This story about the new porter and the old porter who was the golf ball, it has provided me with an answer. Hopefully more will follow. Hester Semley leaned forward with interest. Are you suggesting that the old gate porter and the new gate porter are connected to these killings at Kingfisher Hill? Pas du tout. Poirot was unable to say more because at that moment, Percy stumbled inelegantly back into the room with coffee, cream and sugar precariously balanced on a wobbling tray. Both dogs got up and started to bark. Normally the noise would have disturbed Poirot, but his personal triumph of deduction had rendered him temporarily immune to irritation. Lavinia Stent, a woman whose name he had never heard before and whom he would almost certainly never meet, might have been worse than useless to Hester Semley, but she had been extremely useful to Hercule Poirot. Once refreshments had been taken, and once Percy had left with instructions to make several telephone calls on his aunt's behalf, Poirot reminded her that she had something to tell him about Winnie Lord. Ah, yes, she said. Nobody has seen her at Kingfisher Hill for some time. Is it true that she's no longer in the Devonports' employ? Poirot confirmed that, as far as he was aware, this was true. She was not there when Inspector Catchpool and I first visited Little Quay, and Sidney Devonport said that her return was out of the question. I see. Well, I don't know what she did finally to make herself so unwelcome, but I do know that it could have been anything from the most serious dereliction of duty to something quite inconsequential. Sidney and Lillian took against her long ago, not on account of anything Winnie herself had done, but because of Daisy. Please explain, said Poirot. Well, of course I'm going to explain. Hester Semley glared at him. How could you begin to understand what I'm talking about if I didn't explain? Really, Monsieur Poirot, I don't know if you're in the habit of conversing with people who lack the power of speech and comprehension, or only tell you half of a story. I am in the habit of trying to obtain as much information as possible from those who are determined to tell me as little as possible. I see. Well, I am trying to tell you as much as possible, so please do not interrupt me again. After Frank was sent packing by Sidney and Lillian, Daisy grew close to Winnie. They very quickly became inseparable. Sidney and Lillian were horrified. Their daughter, a Devonport, suddenly all chummy with a servant. They couldn't abide it. Daisy knew this, and it only made her more determined to flaunt her friendship with Winnie. She might not have had the courage to stand up to her parents over the matter of Frank, but she's never been afraid to drive them to fury in more subtle ways, as long as it could not be proved that it was her intention to do so. I think she must have decided to turn Winnie into her new little sister, since Sydney and Lillian had decreed that she must lose a brother. There was much giggling in each other's bedrooms at night, and Daisy sometimes helped Winnie with her tasks in the kitchen. Then there were trips to the theatre, presents, shared confidences, even secret words and codes, according to Verna. In case you're wondering, I only know about all of this because Verna has told me. And the thing is, Daisy is extremely clever. She will have known that Sydney and Lillian depended on Winnie and would have been reluctant to let her go. But they did. They have let her go, said Poirot. That was later, Hester said. When Daisy decided to take Winnie under her wing, she was correct in her assessment. At that time, Winnie was viewed as absolutely essential to the smooth running of the Devonport household. Lillian described her as a servant in a thousand. She and Sydney would have been extremely reluctant to have to start from scratch and train up a new girl. So they tried to go on as usual with Winnie. But privately, with Daisy, they stamped their feet and screamed at her about how she must on no account fraternise with the help. Verna overheard many such tirades. It was not difficult for her to do so. Sydney does not care to keep his voice down when he's angry. Each time Daisy would say, "Of course, Father, you're quite right. I shall try to do better in future." And then she would continue to behave towards Winnie in exactly the same way. Now let me tell you, Monsieur Poirot, it is possible that Daisy was lonely and pining for Frank, and this led to her developing a genuine affection for Winnie as a sort of substitute for her brother. But in my opinion, and Verna agrees, her main aim in pursuing this behaviour was to make her parents suffer. I think she wanted to say to them, without actually saying it, "Look what you've done. You sent Frank away, and now I've made a sister out of your trusty servant, and you hate it, don't you? Well, you should have thought about that, shouldn't you? Do you understand what I mean?" Poirot gave a nod of confirmation, feeling like a pupil being prepared by his teacher for an important test. "All of this had an adverse effect upon Winnie," Hester went on. "I'm not sure why, the tense atmosphere at Little Quay, I imagine, and knowing she was partly the cause of it, but the standard of her work declined. Having always been supremely efficient, cheerful, and able to perform her duties to the highest standards, she became morose, unreliable, and a positive hindrance in every way, though there was an intermediate stage." Poirot opened his mouth to ask what she meant, then thought better of it. "At first, it seems, Winnie was so delighted to have found favour with Daisy that she neglected certain of her duties, simply because her attention was no longer wholly focused upon her work. She was thrilled to have acquired a new sister in the form of Daisy, and she lost interest in everything else. Then, after Frank died, her work deteriorated still further, and this time the slide in standards was accompanied by withdrawal and an unhappy aspect. She went missing once or twice, too, wandered off when the family was relying on her to cook and serve breakfast or dinner, then reappeared a while later without apology or explanation. Of course, she might have been badly affected by the tragedy, but I happen to believe that she was more unhappy about Daisy's reaction to Frank's murder than about the murder itself." "How did—" "Monsieur Poirot, if you ask me how Daisy reacted to Frank's death, I shall set pound and sterling on you. That was the very next thing I was going to tell you. You really must learn the virtue of patience." Hester Semele glared at Poirot in silence for a full 5 seconds. Then she said, "Daisy was distraught after Frank died. Oh, everybody was terribly upset, but Verna said that three people took it much harder than the rest. Helen Acton, Daisy, and Lillian. Daisy's profound unhappiness brought out her cruel streak. And who had the worst of it? Winnie, of course. The adoring disciple. My theory is that Winnie realised only then that she meant nothing to Daisy and never had. She saw that for Daisy she had never been more than an entertaining way to aggravate her parents. Now, I should tell you that Verna disagrees. She thinks that Daisy grew genuinely fond of Winnie after Frank was banished, whereas I think the desire to do something, anything, to make Sydney and Lillian suffer was paramount. I believe Daisy used poor Winnie with that sole aim in mind." Hester sighed. Then, devastated by the loss of Frank, which came so soon after the hope of being reunited with him, Daisy began to persecute Winnie in various subtle ways, constantly criticising her, mocking her. So, of course, Winnie's work in the house deteriorated even further. It comes as no surprise to me to learn that she slipped up once too often, and was given her marching orders. I doubt Daisy will have cared too much about that. Poirot thought of the next question he wished to ask, did not ask it, and was unsurprised when Hester answered it anyway. Which brings me to Oliver Proud and the conversation he had with Godfrey, here, in this room, on the day that Frank was killed. Once Daisy, Richard and Verna had set off with Winnie for Little Key, Oliver was inconsolable. Godfrey told him to buck up or something of the sort, and it all came pouring out. I made myself scarce so that the two of them could talk man to man, though of course I heard every word. No, I will not apologise for that, Monsieur Poirot. This is my house, and I like to hear what people say in it. Monsieur Proud was unhappy about his altercation with Mademoiselle Daisy, Poirot asked. That, certainly, but it was not only that. He felt terribly guilty about the way he had treated Frank, you see. At one time, the two men had been inseparable, like brothers. Frank had stolen money from Sydney only to save Oliver and his ailing father from penury, and Oliver had accepted the money and Frank's advice about how precisely to invest it. Oliver had willingly entered into a business arrangement with Frank. The schools. Do you know about the schools? Poirot indicated that he did. Oliver had been happy to benefit from Frank's criminal activity and from his good head for money and business, Hester Semley went on. But as a friend, he had shunned Frank. As he told Godfrey that day, Frank had come to remind him of everything he wished to forget. His terrible fear of financial ruin and that his father would die in poverty. His tacit participation in a criminal act. Most of all, his inability to rescue himself. He felt indebted to Frank and inferior to him, and his feeling of worthlessness, together with everything else, well, suffice to say that from Oliver's point of view, the friendship could not go on. He and Frank continued to communicate from a distance when they needed to, but they did not see each other again. Oliver told Godfrey that he could not have borne a face-to-face meeting with Frank, so it was no wonder that he dreaded the impending encounter at Little Key. He could hardly avoid Frank now, could he? He was engaged to Daisy, and now Frank had apparently been welcomed back to the family. Pardon me, Poirot was determined to speak and was prepared to be chided for interrupting if necessary. Some minutes ago, you said that Mademoiselle Daisy and Oliver Proud had missed Frank inordinately. That is why Monsieur Proud was eager to go to Little Key as soon as possible once he returned from London, n'est-ce pas, instead of being detained here? Yet you say also that he dreaded encountering Frank Devonport. Are you a fool? Said Hester, bluntly. You think both things cannot at the same time be true? Of course Oliver had missed Frank. He had missed him desperately. If you had only heard him speaking to Godfrey, you would understand completely. It was his low opinion of himself that had prevented Oliver from pursuing his friendship with Frank, not any lack of affection for Frank. All those months that he could not bear to see or speak to him, he wished things were different and felt the lack of his lifelong friend most keenly, but he could not overcome his shame. I see, Poirot nodded, and so once it became clear to him that he now had no choice but to meet Frank face to face, he knew it would be a deeply uncomfortable encounter, and also that it was unavoidable, so he wished to get it over and done with as soon as possible, said Hester. The worst thing of all, he told Godfrey, was that he knew Frank would forgive him without hesitation. That would make him feel even more ashamed. And then there was his anguish over Daisy. She was so excited about Frank's return, it made Oliver feel a little unloved. It reinforced his sense of inferiority. She loves him more than she loves me, he said to Godfrey. She always will. I'm sure I have no need to tell you this, Monsieur Poirot, but I would advise you to question both Winnie Lord and Oliver Proud very closely. An interesting suggestion, Poirot said evasively. You'd be a fool to disregard my advice, said Hester. On the day of Frank's grand return to the family home, both Winnie and Oliver would have been keenly aware that Daisy's feelings for them were nothing compared with the strength of her love for her older brother. How on earth could either of them hope to hold her attention, even for a moment, with Frank around? Jealousy is a powerful motive for murder, Monsieur Poirot. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that. Did Monsieur Proud say anything else to Monsieur La Violette that struck you as important? Asked Poirot. Not really. Only more in the same vein. Self-pity, shame. He seemed to want to confess everything, every past mistake, as if Godfrey were a priest or something. Oh, and he begged Godfrey not to say a word about any of it to Daisy. What past mistakes? Said Poirot.
All the women who had mistreated him, all those he had mistreated. There was one girl who deceived him for months, claiming to be destitute and without family, and then Oliver discovered that she was a member of the Danish royal family. He felt like a prize idiot for having believed her.
The Danish...
Then there was the one with whom he had behaved in an unprincipled and unchristian fashion. That was how he put it. He meant sex, of course. Young people are prudishly reluctant to utter the word, I find. I cannot think why. It's only a word. In any event, Oliver had blamed the girl for the unprincipled activity, when the fault had belonged as much to him, and he felt terribly guilty and ashamed.
The same pattern as with Frank, said Poirot.
Quite, Hester agreed. Oliver was aware of it, too. He recognised and loathed his own hypocrisy. Poor Godfrey. I don't think he knew quite what to say to any of this. Oliver would have been far better off confiding in me, of course. But what man of his age wants to unburden himself to an old woman? Especially about something as shameful as putting a young woman in the family way and then blaming her for it and abandoning her.
There was a baby, said Poirot, immediately alert. This was interesting, he thought.
It did not, I think, go that far, Hester shot Poirot a knowing look. Oliver's narrative became rather oblique at that point, but he did say that the Harley Street doctor, who was attending to his dying father, would not help them, though he easily could have. Oliver called him a hateful man in one breath, then with the next he was denouncing his own appalling behaviour and praising the doctor's wisdom and judgment. Good old doctor, say I, if he would not help Oliver and his lady friend to get rid of a baby. Doctors are supposed to save lives, not end them when they've barely begun.
What became of the woman and the baby? Asked Poirot.
Oliver did not say, not precisely, let me be clear, he did not even say in so many words that there was a baby, nor did he say that they did away with it. But it was quite apparent that they did. One can always find a questionable doctor to do one's bidding if one has the resources. In any case, Oliver treated the girl cruelly afterwards and had nothing more to do with her. And unless he was lying to Godfrey, which I don't think he was, he felt terrible about it, just as he felt terrible about his treatment of Frank. My theory, Monsieur Poirot, is that all of the poor man's past mistakes were replaying themselves in his mind in a rather frenzied way as a result of his anxiety at the prospect of seeing Frank again. His self-loathing had become temporarily uncontrollable. It was evident that Godfrey was quite unequal to the task of making him feel any better. The best he could come up with was to suggest a game of golf. I don't know. Perhaps that works for men, but it certainly wouldn't make me feel any better. Knocking a little ball around with a funny stick for hours on end is the most ludicrous waste of time.
Did Oliver Proud happen to mention the name of his father's doctor? Poirot asked.
The one who would not assist with the solving of the problem.
He expected Hester Semele to answer in the negative, and was pleasantly surprised when she said,
Yes, he did. I remembered it because at first I thought Oliver kept referring to him as F. Grave, the initial F and the surname Grave. But the emphasis was wrong each time he said it, and I soon realised my mistake. It was F. Grave. A strange name. Come to think of it, I have a copy of the London telephone directory. Shall we look it up? I don't know if the spelling is EFF or EPH, and I'm not sure how you think Oliver Proud's father's old doctor might help you to solve either of your two murders.
Please, let us consult the directory.
More slowly than Poirot would have believed possible, Hester Semele rose to her feet.
Follow me. No quick movements, please, or you'll wake the boys. They need their afternoon nap, or else they'll be grumpy all evening.
It took Poirot several minutes to tiptoe as far as the drawing-room door. As he approached it, the sight of something on a nearby shelf stopped him as surely as if he had hit a wall. It was a book that had caught his eye, or rather the title of a book, Midnight Gathering. The coincidence of finding it here was surprising enough, but far more surprising to Poirot was the name of the author.
Sacré tonnerre, he muttered.
Then he smiled. Now at last I can make the fast progress, he thought to himself. I must find Catchpole. There is much to be done. And he cast a guilty eye in the direction of Pound and Sterling, in case somehow his thoughts of movement and speed might drift across to the dogs and wake them from their nap.